Hi, this is Chris, host of A Couple of Drips. Just before we start, I wanted to say a quick word about our subscribers' memberships. If you'd like to help support future episodes, you can subscribe to the show for a few pounds a month. This'll help fund production, coffee, and guest expenses. Simply click on the support button in the episode description. Cheers, and enjoy the show.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Settle in and turn it up. It's time for A Couple of Drips. Coffee, conversation, and occasional quips. Here's your host, Chris Granger.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of A Couple of Drips. It's my great pleasure to welcome today one of my oldest friends, and by that I don't mean you're old. But one of my oldest and longest standing friends, Doctor. Is it Doctor or Professor?
Both, but you pick whichever you want.
Professor Dr. Gianluca Sergi, hello, sir.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm okay, thank you very much, Chris.
Jolly good. Tell everyone how we met, because it's a great story, but you always tell it better.
Well, I was teaching at the University of Staffordshire in Stoke-on-Trent, teaching film and television, and because I had a 9 a.m. class, I thought it was punishment enough for my students to have to listen to me at 9 a.m. I decided to offer coffee services to the students brave enough to come at that time of the day.
Yeah.
And
full silver service on a platter.
It was a white kettle, I think, and some random mugs.
Yeah,
it was terrible stuff. But anyway... But there was this one student who kept on coming with his mug,
yeah,
and saying, yes, please, yes, sir, can I have more, sir, please? And of course, it was you. So that was the beginning of a friendship, for better or worse, as they say.
Definitely. Yeah, kept coming back. What was the module? Can you remember?
No, absolutely can't. Something about film, I guess.
Yes, yeah. I think it might have been Introduction to Film or something.
Maybe.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, very good. Excellent. And then from that, I got a small job working in the office with you, didn't I? Yeah. On the sorting the computers out, because you had your own media server at the time.
Yeah, it was a different...
different era.
This tells you how old I am. So that's actually a funny time, because the internet was becoming a thing. Mm-hmm. But certainly universities were using it mostly for email and some basic stuff. And I got curious, like I often do, and people run for the hills when I get curious usually. And I managed to convince the university to give me £5,000 to buy a server, which at the time they probably thought was a person that would sit in my office.
That was me. That was my role.
Yeah. They obviously didn't know what the hell I was talking about. And the idea of having an IT department that would oversee all of this was science fiction at the time. So they gave me the money, bought the machine, learned how to use the software for my sins, really. But I knew that you were interested in computers, and I knew that also you had the technical know-how that I didn't have. So it was nice to be able to work together, setting up the very first, online
teaching module.
Teaching at the time.
You'd never get away with having a separate server to the main university now, would you?
No, but we're talking now 25 5 years ago.
So yeah, in 1998, yeah, I think it was.
It was
yeah.
a very different yeah. time. Yeah. It was a freer time, but it was also
yeah.
slightly messier time, yeah. let's say.
It was a nice time, though.
It was very nice.
Shared the office with the wonderful Alan Lovell.
Yes.
Sadly no longer with us.
Yes, that's right. With my mentor and putative father in many ways, Alan.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, 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 lovely, very nice times. And from that, we got talking about coffee, didn't we? And coffee machines.
Yes.
And
I
think we had a Krups, a kind of steam powered espresso machine.
It was one of those cheap and nasty things that, however, make surprisingly decent coffee and lasted for such a long time.
It did. Yeah.
And in fact, I still have the coffee grinder, the Kenwood coffee grinder, all ten pounds of it.
Fantastic.
From
the coffee chopper.
Yes, from the late 1990s. Still works. It's still in my office.
Brilliant.
So we graduated from instant coffee to some kind of cappuccino machine.
Yeah.
Which people now think, you know, complicated.
At the time, I think people used to come in the office and think we were mad. I remember we
probably were.
Yeah. Yeah. We shared an office. We had an office next to Liz Poole.
Mm-hmm.
Who's now based at Kiel.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to be fascinated. She'd come in and say, like, what does it do?
Yes. No, but also because we were making a heck of a lot of noise with those things.
Well, those walls weren't sealed as well, so you could hear, if you're in the next office, you could hear every kind of noise we were making.
Yeah. And people used to teach in their offices at the time.
That's right. So you used to do seminars, yeah.
You make any noise in one office, the other office is going to come knocking on the door going like, what in the world are you doing?
Yeah, yeah. What is that?
A good question.
What is
in
that
general.
Milk frothing? Yeah,
no,
yeah.
No, in general, it was a good question about that office in particular, but yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. And from that, I went to stay with you and your family in Italy, and mm-hmm. we ended up buying full-blown cappuccino machines from there, didn't we? You had a bright yellow gadget. Did you have a yellow or a blue gadget?
It was yellow. Which, believe it or not, is still working, although I don't have it anymore. I've given it to a friend. It was a end of the millennium sale. It was 1999, and
yeah.
Gadget had made this one machine, by all intents and purposes, an excellent machine, but maybe they made too many, I don't know. So they were having a big sale, and I remember you bought two and brought two back, and I bought one and brought it back to the UK.
Yeah,
And it's still working 23 years later.
And unbelievably, we didn't put the coffee machines in the cargo hold. We took them on as hand luggage, and there wasn't room in the lockers for them, so they said, oh, just put them under your legs under the seat.
It was a different time.
A 15 kilo coffee machine. Oh, just pop it under your legs under the seat. It was a very different time. Yeah, different. Yeah. I've very vivid memory of the flight back from that, because do you remember we were on the plane with Alan and the plane got hit by the bus?
Yes.
The wing of the plane got hit by the transport bus, who'd already slammed his brakes on and nearly knocked the captain out at one point getting there. Right. And then we're on the plane for half an hour, and then we have to disembark while they check the wing. Yeah,
We made it back. That's all that matters.
In a very strong side wind.
Yes,
I seem to remember an extremely strong side wind.
Fun.
It was great fun. So talking of coffee, I've just noticed we're supposed to do the coffee tasting now, but you've drunk all your coffee. But we can still talk about the coffee. Yeah. Let's do the coffee.
All together now.
1, 2, 3, 4. You're loving that, aren't you? Yeah.
I don't know how you can top that.
Thanks for listening, folks. No. So, Gianluca, what are we drinking?
Okay, so I'm going to have a go at this. It's called Remera Tugire Kawananziza. I think I said it.
I think that was a very good attempt.
It's from Rwanda.
Okay.
It's a very nice coffee. It's quite mellow.
Came from Pact. Quite mellow,
But very nice, not too acidic, which I don't like.
Mm.
And it says blackberry and blueberry. And actually, to be fair,
it says with hints of purple, doesn't it, on the front?
The purple, I don't know. Yeah. But
you got the blackberry and blueberry, do you?
Yeah, I guess the purple is the blackberry and blueberry, I guess.
Yeah. So, mouth feels silky.
Yeah.
I would agree with
my
that.
My mouth is always silky, so there you go. You asked. You asked the question.
I just nearly inhaled that.
Yeah,
nearly
there you go. Guess what?
Nearly had coffee trails.
You give me. Yeah. I might answer them. Yes.
That's staying in. Okay, so tell us a little bit about what you do, Gianluca. Tell us your official job title and other jobs that you do.
So I basically do two things, parallel tracks kind of thing. So one is I teach at the University of Nottingham. I teach film primarily, but the job is film and television. And I'm the director of the Institute for Screen Industries Research. And I say that because that means explains the second track, which is I do research about and sometimes with industry, particularly in the States, in Hollywood, Los Angeles, in San Francisco. I've been
great,
lucky enough to be able to do that. So yeah. those two
So things. How did you get into that? That sounds like quite a sideways shift from teaching.
Yeah, I guess so. I think I was always interested in all aspects of film, both the making side of things and the exhibiting, you know, cinema, stuff from a very, very, very early age. Just I probably started doing something unofficial kind of about movies when I was 11. So a young person's film society in my town in southern Italy. And that always, so that love for movies grew, and it grew into those two separate directions. One was the academic and one was the more kind of working with industry. But the most specific answer comes from the PhD that I did about Dolby, the sound company, and particularly the Dolby sound system for movies. Mm. I wrote a letter, you know, that tells you my optimism in life. I wrote a letter to Ray Dolby when I was still a PhD student saying, oh dear Ray, you know, I'm writing a PhD about you.
Yeah.
And because you have nothing better to do, would you mind talking to me? Expecting absolutely nothing.
Yep.
And instead, Ray was, because I didn't know Ray, obviously I got to know him and he was a wonderful person in so many ways, but he contacted me. He said, oh, how wonderful. And would you like to come to San Francisco and see the company, talk to me about an interview and so on?
Wow.
Which is what I did. And while I was there, he then said, oh, who are you seeing at the ranch? You know, because he was talking about Skywalker Ranch in Lucasfilm, which was only a few miles north of San Francisco. And I said, well, you know, if you know anybody you want to introduce me to. So Ray very kindly opened a lot of doors, and those doors opened more doors. It became kind of a Russian dolls of the best kind.
Sure, sure.
And so from sound, I moved into talking to people who worked in production design. I worked with people who worked in production, film production, edited, all those kind of things. So, and that's when it grew. And then eventually I got extremely lucky about having some pretty phenomenal opportunities to work in the US. When you do research in an ideal world, you share the findings of your research with the people that the research is about, and not just your colleagues and fellow scholars. And I was very keen to do that. It was always something that I wanted to do. And I banged my head against many doors of studio executives. But eventually I managed to find a way to talk to them and present the research and the findings that was of interest to them.
Yeah.
And that led to a number of different research projects with them. At first, it was just simply sharing the results.
Yeah.
I remember doing one on innovation in the film industry that was of particular interest to quite a lot of companies in the Bay Area, in San Francisco, and in LA. And then quite a few of them said, oh, you know, by the way, we would love to do something more about this. And from there, I suggested projects that eventually were taken up on, and I've done quite a lot of those.
Brilliant. So who are some of the people that you've worked with then?
Oh, golly. Well, most of the different studios, Fox, when it was still, it still existed as 20th Century Fox and so on, we did something rather small, but it was like a proof of concept test that the idea of working with studios might work. And then the much bigger ones have been with Sony, which I did one a couple of years ago with Lucasfilm, and which is obviously part of Disney. Done one with the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, which are known as the Oscars.
Yep. Brilliant. Very nice. And what kind of things do you consult for, one of a better word, on what are your sort of topic areas?
That varies quite a lot. Obviously, it depends. But if I were to focus on one area, I would say the future of film. In other words, where is film, meaning not just filmmaking, but also the whole caboodle in many ways, but most importantly, theatrical exhibition. In other words, cinemas, film shown at cinemas. Is there a future for that, et cetera, et cetera. So,
in the light of streaming platforms?
Well, even before streaming, yes, there was already... Every 10, 15 years, somebody says cinema's dead.
Yeah.
And I just written a book on that. So, you know, literally from the very beginning of film...
Yeah.
Every 10 years, somebody declared cinema going dead, only to find out that they...
That's why every 10, 15 years, they revive 3D and then for a while.
Well, luckily, it's not every 10 or 15 years. But in any case, so there's always a crisis of some kind.
Yeah.
And I guess I had accumulated enough experience looking at different aspects of filmmaking that made some of these organizations think, oh, he may be... of assistance. I mean, let's get this straight. They're still going to do whatever the heck they want to do. Yeah. But they were wise, and I think they were beginning to realize that things were becoming so complicated and so complex that they really... It would be really wise to talk to as many people as possible who could provide advice. And I was one of the people that they wanted to talk to.
Yeah.
And that opened up again more doors and more opportunities and so on.
Do you get a sense that they're feeling very threatened by the streaming platforms, or do you think that they have settled down a little bit now and they feel a little bit more confident in their own?
So one thing that Hollywood does very well is panicking. Nobody panics more professionally than people in Hollywood. You have to understand Hollywood, yes, it is a global business.
Mm.
All the more now. I mean, 75% of the box office for Hollywood movies come from abroad. It doesn't come anymore from the US. So obviously it's a global business. But it is very much a company town. Los Angeles still is the center, the epicenter of film in all aspects. But because it's a company town, like all company towns, really, it's much smaller than you think it is. And so if somebody, it becomes an echo chamber. If somebody shouts fire, everybody runs for the exit before even checking whether there is a fire.
Yeah.
Or whether there's a fire extinguisher right there. And maybe it's just simpler.
Yeah.
So, but also you have to understand, and I'm not criticizing them really, because the point is, most of the studios in LA, sorry, in Hollywood, are now owned by shareholders. Mm. Every 3 months, they do a call, investors call, and they expect the people who run the studios to tell them, this is how we're making money for you.
Yeah.
So for a studio to do long-term planning
and
not panic about the short-term things is very difficult because of those things. So in answer to your question, no, I don't think they've got much better, and I don't know that they will get much better and at relaxing about streaming. But there is now enough information, especially now with the significant troubles that Netflix is going through and so on. I think they're beginning to realize that maybe the needle moved a bit too much towards streaming. And also the other important thing the data is showing is that the people who stream are the people who go to the cinema.
Mm.
So it's not an either or. It's not a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
The problem, the bigger problems may lie elsewhere, not necessarily with streaming.
Yeah. So do you personally feel that streaming will ever completely threaten cinema or no?
No. Categorically, no. For a number of different reasons. First of all, if anybody's interested in this, streaming has never really gone through a major crisis. Mm. And this, Netflix is beginning to enter, might become
absolutely
that first crisis. So what we don't know is what's going to happen. Mm. cinema has gone through, I don't know, 10, 15 significant crises, and it's always managed to get through. So there is it's road tested, and streaming is not.
Yeah.
Number one. Number two, they're very different activities. Streaming is watching stuff. Movies is going to the movies. It's a social activity, very different from streaming. So the two are complementary, mm-hmm. because if you stream, you love movies, you watch more movies, you become more interested, mm-hmm. more aware of stars or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, but it cannot replace really cinema also as a moneymaker, because the movies that are shown at the cinema that make money there mm-hmm. are always going to be much more lucrative when they move on to streaming.
Yeah.
If you go straight to streaming, you're missing out on potentially creating that buzz and atmosphere and expectation.
And it's an experience going to the cinema. Of course. You know,
but that's what you say going to the cinema. You don't say, I'm going to see a movie. You go, I'm going to the cinema, because it is the actual social experience of going there, sitting in a darkened theater with strangers. It's a night out or afternoon out or whatever. So it's much more complete social experience than just simply saying, I'm curious about this movie.
Definitely. Do you think, I mean, is there a resistance within the industry to move with the times? Am I right in thinking that the Academy still doesn't recognize Netflix films for awards?
Well, the Academy, in other words, the Oscars, the Academy has evolved quite significantly their position with respect to streaming. But what you have to bear in mind is that the Academy is made of people, men and women like you and me. And therefore, you have your own beliefs and you have your own convictions. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those come from decades of working in a certain way, doing things in a certain way. It's very difficult to shift suddenly your stance on these matters. Also, don't forget, there is an Academy of Television that gives out their own awards, the Emmys. And so, you know, there's a question mark as to why should, you know, originally there was a question mark, why would the Academy give Oscars to something made for television when there is another Academy
that
gives Emmys, which are the equivalent of the Oscars for TV.
Yeah.
So it became, but everything became kind of confused into this maelstrom of is streaming going to kill cinema going? And that's when research, and particularly somebody who can come in like me from an outsider's perspective, not without something engaged or involved or even invested.
Yeah.
That's when he can help assist them, because I can say, look, you know, you're in the trenches. You don't see what I see because I'm up on the hill. That's my job.
Yeah.
So I can see a little more than you, not because I'm better than you, but just because of where I'm standing.
Yeah.
And so let me help you kind of thing. But, you know, again, ego gets in the way.
I was going to say, I can see how coming from outside could be seen as a neutral kind of advantage. But have you met any resistance from within?
I can't help but laugh. yes, of course. Resistance that not even Star Wars could put up, right? That kind of resistance to the dark side of the Force. Yes, of course. But then you have to expect that. They, first of all, when they hear academic, they immediately think, oh, this is a guy who spends his life in his office, never, how could he possibly learn about this?
Yeah.
So you need to, and it's upon you really to develop a way to make him see that actually you do know about this stuff, and perhaps what you know might be of assistance to them.
Yeah.
You don't know more than they do, but you know something, you know the same stuff, but from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And once they realize, no, hold on, this guy understands about this and about that and about that, and then they can go like, okay, well, then we speak the same language.
Yeah.
We want the same thing. That's the other important thing. Mm-hmm. At first, there's always a little bit of suspicion. Why are you doing this? Who are you? Mm-hmm. What is this? And also, don't forget, I come from the UK. Mm-hmm. So the other thing is, why would we listen to somebody who lives 5,000 miles away?
Yeah,
we have some very good universities just around the corner.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I've been extremely lucky to have one or two very high up. Supporters of my work have been very, very high up in the industry. So I've been, you know, you need friends in high places, I guess.
That's great. And talking of friends in high places, you've got a book coming out, haven't you?
Yes, yes.
Would you like to tell us who with?
Yes, of course. With pleasure. It was my good friend Gary Rystrom. Gary was one of my favorite artists growing up. You would know his work, maybe not his name, but you would know his work. Mm. He's won 7 Oscars and his Titanic for sound. This is for Titanic, for Jurassic Park, for Saving Private Ryan. He's done an enormous amount of movies.
Yeah.
So, you know, whenever you go and see a movie about dinosaurs, you can bet your money that
I'll drop Terminator 2 in, because it's one of my favorite films sound wise.
Of course, I've forgotten about that. So, so he's won an enormous amount of awards, and it is, but regardless of the awards, he is, to my mind, one of the top 2-3 best sound designers in the history of Hollywood.
Hasn't he also directed some of the English-speaking versions of some of the Studio Ghibli stuff as
That's correct, yes. Because Gary, for a while, worked at Pixar, because he had done... So, next time you watch a Pixar movie and you see the little lamp, you know, when the logo, the Luxo lamp, he did the sound for that.
Brilliant.
He did the sound for Toy Story. And then, eventually, because Gary's a multi-talented guy... Mm-hmm. He directed a couple of the Toy Story shorts for Pixar, because I think he's always enjoyed directing, and is the perfect guy for directing for a number of reasons. And because of his interest and knowledge of animation, the opportunity came up to direct the American versions of quite
fantastic.
A few of Miyazaki's movies or Studio Ghibli's movies. Because that's something that not everybody understands. You need, why do you need the director if the film is already made? Because, of course, you need to cast the voices. Yep. You need to then direct the voices. So, obviously, you don't do anything with the movie, but you know,
seems a logical progression for someone who's always worked in sound.
And who has a very profound understanding and appreciation of animation, which was the other very important thing. Because animation works very, very differently from live action, just to state the blatantly obvious, but, so as a director in particular, you can't approach animation the same way you would a live action movie, because it wouldn't work.
So what's the book about?
So we just talked about Crisis, and the book is called The Endless Ends of Cinema. Ooh. Because and it's a basically a history of Hollywood through its major crisis, all the times, or most of the times, when it was declared dead. And we go through quite a few of them. I'm not going to list them, obviously, now, but they go from the very beginning of cinema. The very first kind of deadly crisis was at the turn of, not this century, but the one before. So 1900s already, cinema is not even really, it's nothing more than a few days old, and already they're declaring it dead.
Yeah.
And then throughout its history, all the different times. And we end, actually, as we were writing, of course, the pandemic struck.
Oh, yeah.
So we had to add... And I say we had to, because really we had to add a chapter on COVID and everything else. So, yeah, it's a history of Hollywood through its crisis and how it survived, most importantly.
Fantastic. And how long have you been working on it?
A long time. I think close to 4 years now, but I think it's three. We finished in 3 years, and now the corrections are done, the book is submitted, the cover is done, the acknowledgements are done, the thank yous have been written. And so the book is now in production.
So do you have a release date?
Yeah, the book is coming out. Depends on the publisher now, Bloomsbury, how quickly they'll turn the production around. But it's coming out probably early next year.
So you haven't got a specific date yet?
No, they say March, but I'm trying to convince, I tried to convince them to bring it forward a little.
Yeah.
Because I could do with it being out as soon as possible.
Yeah, and this is an academic book.
No, not really. Oh. I shouldn't be saying this, because really I should be writing academic books. No, I don't think you can call it an academic book. I think Gary and I, incidentally, it's extremely rare to have an academic and a filmmaker working together.
I was going to say, someone from inside and outside the industry. Yeah. That's very unusual.
And that was exactly the point in many ways, because we wanted to provide, if some chapters are written exactly like that, in other words, both viewpoints,
great,
from the view from the trenches, you know, from Gary, and the view from the hill from me. But the key point was, we wanted to write a book about how not to be afraid, how to understand that crisis happens. There are narratives around those crises that are developed in general terms. There's a wonderful book called Narratives of Crisis, which was perhaps the beginning of the kernel of the idea. And it's not so much what happens, but how people narrate that story of what's happened. There's an earthquake, okay, obviously destructive power force and everything else, you have to deal with it immediately. But then the story that is told around what that means may impact significantly, in fact it will impact significantly, on the choices that people then make moving forward.
Yeah.
So we wanted to, ideally, particularly for those who work in film or with film in some capacity or other, to realize crises have happened throughout the history of movies. Movies have proven to be very resilient. The system seems to work.
Yeah.
It sputters sometimes and creates problems and everything. But fundamentally, as you know, the building has withstood the tremors. So you need to obviously address any crisis that comes, but you also need to be very careful what you say around it, because you know, streaming, like the internet, like piracy, like before, yes, they have provided significant headaches for people in film, but it is one thing to say this is a headache, painful and everything else, but we can address it. Another thing is to say I'm dying, you know, and there's no point in doing anything because we're dead.
So
hopefully this is going to be of, obviously, hopefully it's going to be of use to scholars as well. But if I were to pick a primary audience, I would say anybody who works and deals with film at all levels, from cinema owners and exhibitors to programmers, to technicians, to filmmakers, to studio executives in particular, I guess.
So why do you think it is that cinema always bounces back? What do you think the key is? What's the strength there? That's
an easy, I mean, I can answer it very easily, is people love movies.
Yeah.
There's never been a moment in the history of movies where people have clearly stopped loving movies. Maybe the way in which they access those movies has developed, changed, evolved, however you want to call it, morphed. There's never been a moment where that was in doubt. Some people say, for instance, they usually claim, you know, post-war, World War II period, the arrival of television, people stay at home, don't go to the cinema and everything else. But if you look at some of the things that were most popular on television were movies. Streaming built its popularity on movies. Now then, of course, you have Stranger Things and other series, but at first, everybody knew that you needed those big popular titles to bring in the subscribers. So ultimately, and it's global, there isn't a single country in the world that doesn't love movies. Not just like movies, but literally love movies.
Yeah.
So I think that's the secret ingredient in this. People love movies, so the rest is how well can we adapt and change and evolve, if innovate, however you want to put it. And the system has been fairly responsive, sometimes slow, because again, for the same reasons that we said before, sometimes it's ego, sometimes it's just the way in which you've done things. And I'm sure this goes across all art forms, you know. Oh, well, we've always done things this way in music. Why should we change it now? You know, or whatever. That's human. That's just human nature.
Yeah.
But I think, again, your answer is audiences love movies.
You talk about changing and evolving there. I mean, technology is certainly one of the ways that they've always tried to do that. I mean, as you say, the introduction of surround sound in the late 70s, early 80s, and then, but obviously whatever the movies do, the home market then tries to imitate. So you get THX in the theatre, then you get THX at home. So, and I know one of your big early academic interests was sound and the development of surround sound. What triggered that early interest?
A lot of different things, I guess. I was 13 when Star Wars came out, the first Star Wars. So that dates me, I'm afraid.
I was seven, so.
Well, there you go. But I was the target group. I was the target group for the movie.
Yeah.
And I remember going to see the film and coming out with some friends and saying, "Oh, well, the sound was amazing." And all my friends said, "What are you talking about?" You know,
Notice the sound.
What are you talking about? And I thought, "Oh, that's odd, and that's interesting." But there was something about the way in which sound was used in that movie that kind of triggered an understanding of the possibilities.
Yeah. Ben Burt, wasn't it?
Yes, Ben, whom I then ended up meeting a few years later, also to say thank you. Ben had done an amazing job with things that up to that point, perhaps it's not that there hadn't been films before that had done marvelous things with sound. There are examples from very, very early on. The first King Kong with sound is a great example of wonderful use of sound. And it doesn't have to be spectacular movies, obviously. I'm just mentioning King Kong because it's one of those famous examples. Mm. Adventures of Robin Hood, the one with Errol Flynn, for instance, is another very good, famous example of arrows flying by and excitement and swashbuckling and stuff. But there was something about Star Wars that was undeniably different. Mm. And the sheer amount of modes of address from sound through robots' vocalizations. I mean, now we take it for granted. You know, you see R2-D2, you know, the little trash can robot in anything. And of course it's going to beep, right? But that was not of course at the time.
Yeah.
And yet it sounds more human and more emotional.
Yeah,
it's capable to express emotions sometimes more than a lot of actors.
Sound,
a lot of actors have gone through Star Wars over the years. So, you know, and that was
Ben. Yeah, I think the only thing we'd had before that was Robbie in Lost in Space.
Yes, well, in fact, Lost in Space is an interesting example again of the use of sound. Or Forbidden Planet is a great example of the use of sound.
But the theremin and all that. So.
Yeah. And the other great thing was that Ben understood that you could actually identify a character by a sound.
Mm.
And this had not really been developed that much in the past.
In the way that a leitmotif is used in music.
And he understood there was something that he could do. And obviously the most famous example of them all, I don't even need to say, is Darth Vader's breathing.
Yeah.
Now, it's impossible, almost anywhere in the world, if you hear even a snippet of that sound, there's no way that you're confusing who that is.
Yeah.
Right? And it was that particular ability to create those kind of sounds that alerted me to that possibility. So I got curious. Curiosity. And then I didn't know much about the technology, but I made it a point to learn enough to understand how it worked and so on.
Did you do the teenage thing? Did you have the tape recorder and try making your own?
I did a lot of I did a lot of stupid things. I did have a tape recorder.
Change the speed and
I did a lot of things, but that in many ways that was interesting because it also alerted me to the fact that the technology had very little to do with the quality of the work, and because you know you can get the best technology in the world in your living room and you will not be able to to do anything particularly good unless again you are not just talented in a kind of supernatural way but unless that's really what your job is and you develop the skill and so on. So that and then again because of Ray Dolby, whom when I started doing the PhD I didn't even know existed, I didn't know that there was a Mr. Dolby, because of Ray I managed to meet a lot of people who work with sound, in sound, and I realized, you know, these guys are extremely intelligent. They are very well spoken. They can make perfect sense of what they're doing, despite the fact that sometimes they say, well, I just did it. And I was like, no. But they were always very articulate. But not that I expected them to be inarticulate, bubbling fools, but because of the technology, you tend to think this is a technological thing. So you tend to think about people who work in sound and not just sound in other areas of filmmaking as fundamentally technicians. which is a
engineers rather than artists.
Yeah, it's a totally incomplete, not incorrect, because they are also very well technologically versed, but they're fundamentally artists. And learning about their art switched on my interest in other parts of filmmaking.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There are literally billions and billions of podcasts out there, so the chances of finding intelligent life amongst them are so infinitesimally small as to not even be worth looking. Could you then have stumbled onto the one podcast where intelligent life could exist? No. No, you haven't.
So let's find a little bit more out about Gianluca. I believe he used to be a semi-pro basketball player. Discuss.
Oh, that little nugget. And if you saw me in the street, that's the least sport you would think.
Gianluca's 4'1". Yeah. Anyone listening?
Yeah, well, maybe not that, but certainly, I'm not 6'4". No, I'm really not that tall. So a guy of average height playing basketball is not something that you would imagine. But you know, when you're young, you just think, what the hell?
What was your position?
I'll give it I was just a playmaker or a guard, as they call them now. Obviously, because, again, I couldn't go against somebody 19 feet tall.
But you did well with it, didn't you?
Yeah, because I took to it like a fish takes to water, I guess. And And between the age of 15 and 19, it was kind of my other life. It was movies and basketball.
Wow.
And I played. And then eventually I got asked if I wanted to play for this team in a semi-professional league, and they would pay. Obviously, when I say pay, don't start thinking millions or anything. But the idea of being paid to play basketball is like, I like this. But, you know, reality eventually catches up. I was okay and good enough to play at that level. But if to move to the next level up to the pros, it's a completely different game. Evidently, I wasn't good enough to go and play it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking.
It's a nice thing to have done, though.
Yeah. No, it was amazing. I met some very good friends who are still friends today. And also, I suspect, it helped me understand, you know, how to remain in decent health, I guess. Yeah. Which is not a bad thing when you get a little older. So,
anyway. Yeah, definitely. And now you're a massive baseball fan.
I've always liked American sports quite a lot because of movies, I guess. You know, some certain mystique around certain sports, particularly baseball, that has almost a mythological kind of standing.
Yeah.
I'm reading right now a great book called City of Dreams, which is about LA and the arrival of the Los Angeles Dodgers in LA from Brooklyn, where they were based. And there's a lot of very good sports writing, books about sports in America. We don't really have that tradition in Europe in general or in the UK. There are some decent books. They're usually biographies, whereas in the States, again, there's this awareness of the way in which sport impacts on society and on the growth and development of particular sections of society and entire cities. And LA is a very good example of that. I could tell you 50 million stories of how baseball impacted on LA and changed the city, not just the sports scene. So I've always been interested in that combination. and that relationship. And baseball represented this, you know, kind of a gateway to understanding American culture and the American psyche to some extent, much more than the other sports. I mean,
I'm
a huge basketball fan, yes, but basketball very different than baseball, not just in terms of rules and regulations, but also in the relationship with the general public.
Yeah.
Not for nothing, baseball used to be called, you know, America's pastime. And American football, or football as they call it in the US, I also liked for different reasons. And that was because, again, the culture and the writing there was a lot about Roman gladiators and that kind of stuff. So it had a different kind of epic tone to it. But baseball has something about it that was different from the other two, and it was very much something that fascinated me and continues to fascinate me, both as a sport and as a metaphor for American culture.
Yeah, we living in America when you learned to speak English.
I learned to say a few things in English when I was in school, because in Italy it still is obviously compulsory to study at least one foreign language. In fact, it might even be two now. But because television and film in Italy are dubbed, unlike northern countries in Europe.
Yeah.
That was not certainly I was not proficient, shall we say.
Yeah.
But I had, like most southern Italians, I had relatives in the US and came to visit, and I said, why don't you come visit? And I said, yeah.
And
I was 17 and I went and spent a few months.
What an adventure.
Yeah. Absolutely pivotal moment in many ways. So I spent I spent 6 months in Cleveland, Ohio, and that's what I really learned how to speak.
Did it click fairly quickly with you?
Actually, it did. And I think it was just cultural.
I think some people are just wired that way.
Maybe. I don't know. There are some languages that I know I'm not going to, you know, it's never going to click even if I try, because it's just my brain.
German and Russian.
Well, but nothing, obviously.
Mandarin.
Against those languages. But there's something.
Yeah.
Sometimes. So with English, he came fairly natural. But also because, again, I had the opportunity to learn it when I was still relatively young. I mean, 17 is still fairly young.
Yeah, the brain's flexible.
Yeah.
So one of your other loves and obsessions is jazz. How did you discover jazz?
In many ways, it's funny because I realized there was a clear connection with African-American culture, black culture, which I hadn't quite tweaked and realized, because a white guy from Southern Italy doesn't necessarily immediately think, that's my point of reference there.
Sure.
I don't know. The basketball thing was obviously something that for a long time, it wasn't just obviously African American sport, but certainly it had a particular standing amongst the African American community. It still does.
The Harlem Globetrotters would have been huge at the time you were growing up, I guess.
Yeah, but it wasn't just that. It was more the fact that if you picked a young kid from some, you know, not particularly well off part of any of the major US cities, if you asked him, if it was an African American kid, you ask him which sport you want to be, they would most immediately say basketball.
Yeah, yeah.
For a number of reasons. When I was growing up, that is.
Yeah.
So we're talking about late 60s, 70s. So I got curious, and the more I got curious, the more I learned, and then I stumbled first into funk, which again, that was the funny thing, because my favorite band at the time was Earth, Wind & Fire.
Ah, great.
And of course, Earth, Wind & Fire have fusion music, so you get quite a lot of jazz influences in the music. And then that was the next step, the logical step. But I kind of felt scared of jazz music for a while. Mm. It felt too sophisticated.
A little bit elitist sometimes.
Yeah, for a 16, 17-year-old. Yeah. It felt like a little bit too...
Yeah.
But I wasn't that much into pop music. But again, not for snobbish reasons. It's just that I found it difficult to find bands that I like. I liked rock music and so on. I liked all kinds of music, heavy metal maybe not so much, but anyway, I liked all kinds of music. But with jazz, it was almost like I stood at a distance from it. Every now and then I would hear something and say, yeah, that sounds like I want to listen more of that. But then I would listen to something more. I said, I'm not ready for it. And then eventually I started dipping my toes. And at first you dip your toes with the usual stuff, because you hear soundtracks or movies that use usually it's always Kind of Blue, it's always Miles Davis one way or another.
Yeah.
And I liked it. But I was, the curious thing about that particular record was that I was more curious about who was playing with Miles Davis.
Yes.
Than with what Miles Davis was doing with the music itself.
Yeah.
Not, I don't mean to be heretic here, but
No.
And then I found out who was playing with Miles Davis, and I thought, okay, I need to listen more to these guys.
Yeah.
And of course, Bill Evans was on the piano and John Coltrane was on the sax. And and those two opened up, you know, the sax world, which is the one that I really grabbed me, despite the fact that I used to play piano, but it was sax.
Yeah.
And through, you know, Coltrane, you start wondering who else was there out there.
Yeah.
And then eventually I stumbled into Charlie Parker, and I thought, okay, yeah. Now I'm where I want to be.
Yeah.
And nothing. It was, I fell in love with Bird, with you know, Charlie Parker, and with his music, and I thought, this is amazing. And what I don't understand and what I can't engage immediately, I like to spend a bit more time with.
Yeah.
And educate myself, because like everything, it's an education.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's been a long, long time passion now for the past 20 years. I can't tell you who played in the 1963 version of. No, I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not like
not
that.
Not an aficionado.
And it's, you know, your music is your thing. And I would never be able to express myself in the same knowledgeable and way that you can, but I know what I like, and I probably know why I like it now.
Yeah, that's great. Food and cooking, I've got down on my notes here.
Well, yeah, stereotypical.
Tell me a little bit. Well, you're an Italian, yes. So tell me about food.
Well,
how did you develop a passion? Where's that come from?
I think it's my creative thing. I'm beginning to realize now. By the way, it's not something that has always been there. And in fact, neither food nor coffee nor wine were things that I was particularly interested in when I was in Italy. Yeah. And the only reason why I can work out was that they were so readily available.
That you took them for granted.
You didn't have to spend a minute thinking about, oh, wait a minute, this is good. Because, you know, you don't have a baseline. If the baseline is the sky, you go like, well, wait a minute.
And then you came to England.
But you said that. I was going to say, I had the experience of different cultures, and first of all, when you go to the States, you realize the influence of Italians in general, in general.
Huge.
But certainly Italian food on American culture. Oh, yeah. And I thought, oh, this is interesting, because you start experiencing your own culture has been mirrored back to you.
Yeah.
And inevitably, you kind of recognize yourself a little bit in that mirror image, but there are other parts that you don't quite grab or grasp or whatever. And then coming here, when I moved to the UK, coffee was a thing that other people drink. And food, it was a time where if you ordered food in a pub, they'd give you a packet of crisps, if you were lucky, right? So the notion of being interested in food, and food as a creative outlet, enterprise, and everything else in the UK, certainly, when I moved here, was not a thing. Mm. Over the years, however, that has changed. It has changed dramatically.
Very much so,
So supermarkets started bringing in a lot more, a greater variety of food.
We've now got gastropubs. And
yes, but pubs got into the act also because there was a lot of money to be made, obviously, in that, with mixed results, let's say. But nevertheless, evidently, and the rise of the celebrity chefs on television, which is very much a British phenomenon. That tells you a lot, because it really started here in many ways, at least on a mass scale. The US had people like Julia Child before, you know, very famous celebrity chefs, but the rise of people like Jamie Oliver and everything else, evidently the culture here changed pretty dramatically around food, and now the availability of food, although now prices are pretty insane, but supermarkets in the UK, and maybe British people don't realize, but you know, most of the countries have smaller supermarkets.
Yeah.
There's still corner shops and other things where you get your food, you know, delicatessen. Yeah. But here you can go to the supermarket, any major brand, and I don't need to pick one here, and you can find actually a remarkable selection of food, and the quality is pretty good. So it's, in other words, it's possible for the average person to try to be creative and explore a little bit what you can do with food.
Yeah.
And so I became more interested, and I would say that I can see that becoming more and more and more a thing that I do, because it first of all, it relaxes me a lot.
Yeah.
And I like the challenge. If you go only 10 minutes, you go 10 minutes. If you go, because some people say, I would love cooking if I had the time. Well, I know what you mean, but cooking doesn't have to be complicated, and Italian food certainly doesn't need to be complicated. So sometimes 10 minutes is enough, and sometimes you have half an hour, and you go, what can I do now? And so I know you like...
Sounds a nice combination, putting the jazz on, cooking the food, and...
Yeah, and I think the idea there is again, around the notion of creativity. I used to play piano when I was very young. I completely forgotten how to play piano. I would love to go back to playing piano, as you know, is one of my... things I want to do.
Never too late.
Yeah, one of the things I want to do eventually. I deal with movies, but I don't make movies. So I think everybody has a creative outlet in them, or more than one probably. I cannot draw if my life depends on it. Singing is best left to others. You don't want to hear me singing. But I guess, food, cooking. Is my thing.
Yeah, you're responsible for getting me into wine because you introduced me to Californian wines, Zinfandel, and...
Well, wine is a funny thing because, again, I didn't drink wine when I was interested. what an idiot. But I just wasn't into wine. And it's just something relatively recent. And it's not like I'm an expert or I can afford buying expensive wine. But, again, the issue is not so much money.
Yeah.
In fact, that's the challenge in many ways. Can you get something decent? Can you have a good experience without having to?
We've had a few nice wines though on our travels, haven't we? The Francis Ford Coppola wine.
Yeah,
I think there's some Skywalker. Is the Skywalker Ranch wine as well?
Yeah, they do, but those are not cheap. They do make
on the ranch. They actually have their own.
Mr. Coppola, famously a good Italian. Got an interest in wine, and eventually, once he became famous and had enough money, he started his own vineyard in Northern California, which is a good area to start a vineyard. And then
all around the Napa Valley is ridiculously
hot. that's where he started his vineyard originally. Although now his vineyards are a lot of different places. And then George Lucas, in later years, but still, he got in fact, if you go to the ranch, if you go to Skywalker Ranch, there's quite a lot of buying around there, and they make a couple of wines there. Obviously, they don't make an enormous number of bottles. I think he's now bought quite a lot of land in Italy, I think, and in France, to grow more grapes for wine. But yes, you can buy a bottle of wine. They're usually quite expensive. I usually ask Gary around for dinner, and I say, Gary, bring a bottle.
Nice.
No.
Just because he works there and he can go to the store easily.
I think he's a little bit more highly paid.
Can you pick anything up, Gary? Just a cheap bottle of something from the corner shop?
No, that sentence doesn't quite compute in Northern California. But it's always a pleasure. When you are in that part of the world, that's one of the pleasures, really. They make phenomenal wine there. Yeah. And it's easy to find good wine for relatively low money. And why not?
Absolutely. Beautiful. Is Gary still working at Skywalker, or is he? Because he's relocated recently.
Yes, he's moved to another city, but he still works. Just finished, I think I can say that. I think I saw him 2 weeks ago. He's just finished Indiana Jones 5.
Wow.
And Spielberg's latest movie, which is called The Fablemans, which is basically an autobiographical movie that Spielberg has just made.
Nice.
Actually, as Gary said, basically he's retired, but when Spielberg calls, he will always say yes. So long as Mr. Spielberg continues to make movies, I think Gary will continue to work on those movies. But he's trying to dial it back because it's extremely demanding. We had dinner, I can't remember what time last time I was in LA, because he was working on these things, and they go on sometimes until very, very late at night. It's not an easy life. It's well paid, but it's not easy.
So has he got a studio at home now that he works from?
Or? He's always that, but all of these people at that level have some kind of setup at home. But the pandemic, I think, fast-tracked some developments that would have happened probably anyway, given the technology and particularly the fast lines and the ability to work remotely.
Yeah.
And a place like Lucasfilm, for instance, they have offices everywhere. They're in London, they're in Singapore, they're in Vancouver, they're in San Francisco, they're in LA. So, they can't hop on a plane every time they need to see someone. Yeah. So remote working was not new, but I think, his moving to a different location means that also he can have his own little studio there, his man cave or however you want to call it, and do his work.
Beautiful.
But there will always be times when he will need to go to either LA San Francisco or whatever to be with the director in the room doing the final mix.
It sounds like you've done a fair bit of plane hopping yourself in this in the pursuit of these.
You can say, yes. Yes, I'm probably
going okay for your air miles.
I'm going to hell probably because of the environment. the environment is not probably the reason why I'm going to hell, but nevertheless, that's probably one of the reasons on the list. Probably number five or six.
I believe you're going up in a very eco-sound plane soon.
Yes. Sorry, I had to for a moment. Yeah, I'm still trying to recover from
Segway.
Yes, sorry. No, because I'm still getting used to the idea. Yeah, so I've always liked planes, almost at a nerdy level, I'm afraid to say. And I've always wanted to fly in a glider.
Mm.
And I had never done it. And recently,
fabulous,
because of a number of catastrophes in my life, I thought, okay, well, you know, I think it's time to do something. So I'm going to be in a glider very soon.
Fantastic. Where's that going to take place?
Near Leicester. The south is Leicestershire, South Leicestershire.
Beautiful! Yeah,
there's a flying school there, and that's what I'm going to do. And again, a glider and glide.
That'll be very nice.
And if I don't die, we'll do another
podcast. You won't. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. But anyway, you know, I've always loved flying and a glider.
Yeah, I got over my fear of flying. With traveling with you frequently, but that got me over it.
You know, you're the one that I admire because you know I never really. You know, everybody has a little moment of apprehension because our natural place is Earth, not the sky. But I never been particularly concerned about flying. But I always admire the fact that you and my mother, for instance, was like that. You know, she really was terrified of flying.
Mm.
So anybody who manages to overcome fear. And that's
it's one of those things, isn't it? It's a scale, and on one side you've got fear of flying, and on the other side you've got one opportunity to see places and to see the world and to travel and do things. And you think you've got to get over this if you want to; otherwise, you never walk out of the house. You know.
Yeah, but that's like everything. That's a rational argument, and there is the irrational fear that grabs you and so you know give yourself some credit overcoming those irrational fears despite the fact that rationally you think well that's you know well,
yeah
it's the safest form of transport
yeah.
yeah but that's the brain speak
yeah yeah
the heart says well you can crash.
I just hate the airports now.
Yeah, well, let's not talk
about I like airports. The coffee bars, it's just the queuing.
Let's not talk about airports right now. Not fun places to be.
Climb to fame, it's your chance to drop a name. Trying to outdo each other's kind of lame. One-upmanship is the only aim. Climb to fame, climb to fame, climb to fame.
Okay, so claims to fame then, Gianluca. Tell us what you've got.
Now, not what you want. you know, we're talking about people who love stories, so I'll just tell you a story. In fact, I just remembered another story, which is also funny, the John Landis story, but I'll leave it out, just in case John Landis listens to this.
John Landis won't be listening, and I know the story, I was sort of hinting at it earlier, don't know if you picked up on it.
I'll leave it out because it's delicate, let's say. But this other one it can be told, and it's a sweet little story. So the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which effectively is the most important organization in Hollywood, representing all the different filmmakers, has a board of governors, which effectively runs the Academy. It runs the Oscars, but also they do a lot of other things, not just the Oscars. And they meet regularly to discuss, the future of the organization, film, the Oscars, awards, and all these other things. For a number of reasons, which would make another interesting story, I was invited to go and speak to the board of governors. Once I recovered from the shock, I looked at the list, who was the governor at the time.
Nice.
And Steven Spielberg was the governor at the time. Tom Hanks was the governor at the time. A lot of Michael Giacchino, the composer, was the board of governors. So I thought, oops, this is a pretty...
This could be a fun evening.
I better know my stuff, put it that way. If I'm going to go and stand in front of these people, an academic from the UK. So, as you can imagine, it was a bit of pressure on me to do a good job. And it come the evening, the very kind woman who was effectively helping me set up and everything else and getting ready said, oh, by the way, they start at 6:00. They have some private conversations they need to have in the big boardroom. So you need to picture the scene here. Imagine a very long wooden table with chairs and cameras everywhere, with screens and people connected from different parts of the world, those who couldn't be there because they were filming for whatever. And then there's all these very serious looking people around the table. And of course, some of you recognize because, you know, some are like famous actors or famous directors or whatever. And you think, yeah, this is going to be fun. So there's this big room, and the walls were all made of glass, so you could see in and they can see through out. So the lady, you know, handling me at the time said, if you come at 6:30, there's going to be food, you know, in the atrium, so you can have food there, and then when they finish we'll call you and you can come in and do your presentation. So I said, okay, fine, so I'll have a little bit of time to just, you know, relax for a moment. So there is an elevator going up in the headquarters of the academy that then opens up on the floor where the boardroom with all these people is.
Nice.
So I thought, well, I'm going to go up this elevator. The doors are going to open. I'm going to walk into the atrium. I can see where they are. I can quickly scan the room and see who's there, have some food, and then I will be taken to the room to do the presentation. Oh dear, that's not how it went. How it went was that they had actually finished earlier than expected. So this poor woman had been trying to phone me to warn me that the moment I actually arrived and stepped out of the elevator, they would effectively all be looking at me arriving in. So the elevator's door opened, and before I realized, the whole room was just looking at me, and I felt, you know, a lot of those dreams where you feel naked. It was pretty much like that. I thought, this is a little bit complicated. You know, man, that dead man walking kind of thing, right? We're going to execute you now. But before I could recover from the shock, I saw this very familiar figure making a beeline for me, coming with a hand, you know, hand stretched out, and it was Laura Dern. Before I could recover from the fact that, in fact, I was being, you know, laser looked at by this this room full of very famous and important people, I had a major film actress running to say, oh, hello, welcome, and everything else. And she said, oh, I'm Laura Dern. And I had to refrain myself from saying, no, you are Laura Dern. But she, you know, they were all, you know, it was a fun, in many ways, it was a fun evening. Everybody was very friendly, and I got to meet a lot of people whose work I admired for a very long time. And so it was good, and I survived. But
brilliant.
By having Laura Dern making a beeline for you is not something that happens,
it doesn't happens happen every very day. Often, no.
So it was kind of a funny story. That's the story I can't tell. There's another story involving John Landis that I can't tell.
Would you like to tell the John Landis story for the members only area? Well, and then he's not going to hear it.
No. No, because I don't want to be hit by by a truck tomorrow afternoon. No, it's an interesting, let's just say it's a fun story, which actually takes place at Frankie Musso, which is the most prestigious historic restaurant. And in fact, if you watch The Offer, which is a series Paramount Plus, which is just launched in the UK, is made on the making of The Godfather. There's a lot of it which is shot in Frankie Musso, because that's where all the deals were being made. And and there was an interesting encounter with a very famous director.
If you wanted to tell it, I could chop it out and keep it for
I'll tell you
ransom privately. No, I know the story.
I'll tell you privately.
So I've got some interesting stuff written down in my notes here, and the next one I've got written is Darth Vader's respirator.
Yeah, no, but that, I kind of mentioned that before. I remember once, I think Gary and I had started working on the book. It was early days, so a few years ago. And he said, oh, have you ever met Ben? Because Ben Burt, you know, the
yeah,
you know, one of the top two, three, again, sound designers in the history, one of the godfathers of contemporary sound, who had done all the breathing for Darth Vader, the sounds for R2-D2, all the sounds for Star Wars, multiple Oscar winner, etc., etc., Indiana Jones, Whip, and all these other things. So Ben was obviously a hero of mine for a number of different reasons, but I never, despite the fact that I've been at the ranch several times for interviews, research, whatever, I never actually met him because it didn't happen. And Gary casually said, have you ever met Ben? I said, no. I said, well, let's go and introduce you to Ben. So I went, and Gary being Gary, Gary dropped me basically in Ben's office and said, well, Ben, meet Gianluca, Gianluca, meet Ben. And he left. So
great.
I sat there and we talked for about an hour with Ben, and I suddenly, at the corner of my eye, caught this respirator that was, you know, the kind of underwater, you know, the kind of things, subs.
Yeah.
And I kept on, my eye kept on, you know, looking at it. It was literally 1 inch away from where I was sitting.
Yeah.
And at one point, then Ben finally must have realized what I was doing. He said, yep. So that's the respirator I used to do Darth Vader's voice, if, in case you're wondering. So I was sitting, like, I was sitting next to the thing that had actually switched me on to sound in the first place.
Wow, that's so full circle.
It was a nice, it's one of those moments when you think, well, you know, it's a geeky thing, it's a nerdy thing, but it's strangely satisfying to see that the things are going to come full circle.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And talking of coming full circle, you had a nice write-up in Vanity Fair, didn't you?
Vanity Fair, which is virtually on every coffee table in Hollywood. Maybe not so much in... I don't think many people really know quite how popular Vanity Fair is in Hollywood here, for instance, right? It's just one of those things. And people think a Vanity Fair is just what it sounds like, right?
Mm.
One of those glossy magazines. It is a glossy magazine, but it is one of those magazines that people in the industry read because there are interviews and some good articles and some very good people writing in it. And they were doing an article on the future of film, and I had just done my work with the Academy that I was just telling you about. And the producer within the Academy said, oh, you might want to speak to this guy, and gave the reporter my name. So I get an email saying, do you want to do the interview? And I said, well, you know, thinking they want like a sound bite, something like a sentence. I said, yeah, sure, I'll speak with you. Again, that tells you quite how naive I am in many ways. So we did this interview, and I realized that the interview went on for almost as long as this podcast went. And I thought, is all of that for just one sound bite? Okay, fine. So I go away, and about 2 weeks later, I get an email from somebody from inside the Academy. The inside was just, nice write-up with an exclamation mark. And I thought, what is he talking about? So, and then somebody else sent me an article saying, did you see your piece of Vanity Fair? And I thought, what piece of Vanity Fair? So I wrote to the woman. I said, but by any chance, did you publish this? I said, oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot to send. So she sent me, whether she forgot to send me the thing or she didn't send me the. So she sent me this article, and it was, the first half of the article was basically a profile of my research and my work and the stuff that I'd done in the camp.
Anything else you want to mention on the claim to fame section?
No.
Breakfast for George Lucas?
No. I told you that was lunch, and it wasn't with George Lucas. George Lucas was sitting behind me at the ranch.
It's near enough.
No, but look, that's where he works. So it's hardly a claim to fame. I just happened to be in the same place.
Surprised to hear he still actually works there.
So his office is, I don't know whether I should say this, but obviously he's got several offices, but one of his offices is still in the main house at the ranch.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was what he built, and it was his labor of love. So I, of course, he would have still a place there.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's not a contemporary building, is it? It's very much sort of...
There's a story, yeah. So so Mr. Lucas is a storyteller, if nothing else, and an exceptional businessman, by the way. And he thought the ranch needed a story. Mm-hmm. And when he built it, and you're talking about around about the late 70s. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think it opened in 80, 81, 82, something like that. he decided that the story was, and I'm trying to remember exactly the story, that this family, an Italian family, would be on this boat, travel the world, and eventually end up in California, and find that the land was fertile, and the grapes, you know, the vines would grow, and would start a vineyard, and that's the place. And the entrance to, not to the ranch, but the entrance to the tech building, which is where all the magic kind of happens, has this kind of wrought iron gate, or arch, more than a gate, archway, that says Viandante del Cielo in Italian, which actually means Skywalker. So he thought that that would be the name of the vineyard, and as a consequence, that's why it's called Skywalker Ranch and so on. Obviously, that's completely made up story, but he wanted, I thought it's actually kind of endearing that he wanted a story attached to the vineyard. And this is why some of the buildings there are meant to resemble, in answer to your point, are meant to resemble kind of slightly older style buildings, and not modern.
The library's modern. Like a beautiful stained glass.
Yeah, so Mr. Lucas is an art collector, and is a very big art collector. In fact, he's building right now the museum. I can't remember. I think it's called the Museum of Narrative Arts, which is going to be built just outside the University of Southern California in downtown LA. Mm-hmm. It's a $1 billion project, so it's a huge it's money. And it's all going to be about narrative arts, starting from paintings and everything else. And he has some amazing paintings, actually, at the ranch. If you're going around, you can see, you know, it's like, oh, wait a minute, is this the original? Yes, it is. And so he's always had a particular interest in art. And the library there, well, the whole of the main house where his office is, and underneath his office is the library, where we did, Gary and I did a lot of research for the book. The library is a beautiful, absolutely gorgeous place with, you know, art deco, this, that, and the other, and everything, even the little lights, like lamps, were custom made and ordered by, you know, to be made by local artists and so on. So, you know, you could say, well, he did that because he had the money to do so, but it's a lot of people who have a lot of money don't even remotely think of creating that environment. He had this idea of creating an environment where filmmakers will flourish and creativity will flourish. So whatever you think of his movies or whatever, that place is a special place, and anybody who works there will tell you it is a special place.
Yeah,
a privilege to have been able to visit and work there. So.
Beautiful. And the main building is... main building's kind of...
The tech house?
What would you... Yeah, what period would you say?
Well, the tech house is supposed to be, again, the main kind of vineyard place and or piece, if you want, in a thing. And it's difficult to... I'm sure there's somewhere there's an even... It's probably a year, a fictitious year put there, but I would say probably like, I don't know, late 19th, early 20th century, because again there are some elements, some aspects of it which are very much 20th century, early part, particularly if you go into the Stag Theater, which is the main cinema inside the tech building. A beautiful place, and yes, quite a bit of features that you could say, well, if I'm gonna date this, I'm probably gonna date them to Art Deco 1920s, 30s maybe. So that's the idea, but the whole place, as you know, the whole place is it's a gorgeous construction.
Pants or boxers?
I would say pants.
Okay. Any reason?
No, if I'm not going to tell you the John Landis story, I'm not going to tell you.
I didn't even mention John Landis.
I know, but support, I guess. Yes. Comfort, delight.
Why did pants remind you of John Landis? I have no idea.
No, it's just funny. Just funny thing, pants. I had that was a favorite expression of one of my dear friends who died recently. Whenever something didn't work out, you know, time-honored expression, it was pants.
Pants, brilliant. That's a good way to end. Well, thank you very much for coming on, Charlie Curis.
Thank you. I hope that your listeners actually found some fun in the listening.
I'm sure they will, and I'm sure a lot of them would be very interested in some of the stories there. So thanks a lot for coming on, and thanks for listening, if you're listening, and I hope you'll come on again at some point.
Thank you,
and try and get you and Gary on for a double header episode at some point. That would be. I'm sure we can set that up remotely.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Gianluca. Thanks for listening, and hopefully see you again at some point. Cheers.
Listening to A Couple of Drips. The show was conceived and presented by Chris Granger and is a Cup the Mic production.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, Chris here. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to support the production of future episodes, then subscriptions are available. Simply click on the support button in the episode description. See you next time.